Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, takes a look at the 47th World Day of Communications, which has as theme social networks, portals of truth and faith, new spaces for evangelization. But first, our traditional appointment with Jill Bevilacqua for her reflection on the Sunday Gospel, part of the series by the intriguing title, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. It begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
Jesus looked up to heaven and said, I do not pray for my disciples alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their word, that all may be one. As you, Father, are in me and I in you, I pray that they may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. I have given them the glory you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I living in them, you living in me, that their unity may be complete. So shall the world know that you sent me, and that you loved them as you loved me. Father, all those you gave me I would have in my company where I am, to see this glory of mine, which is your gift to me, because of the love you bore me before the world began. Just, Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you, and these have known you that sent me. To them I have revealed your name, and I will continue to reveal it, so that your love for me may live in them, and I may live in them.
Although between last Sunday and today the Feast of the Ascension has been celebrated, the Easter season is not over yet. The Paschal candle, image of the risen Lord, is still in the sanctuary to remind us that the 50 days from Easter to Pentecost are one feast day, and that the glorified Christ is still present in his community. So the revised liturgy has returned us to the ancient tradition of joyous thanksgiving and frequent alleluias. And if we read Luke's account of the Ascension, we find that after Jesus was carried up into heaven, they worshipped him, and then went back to Jerusalem full of joy, and they were continually in the temple praising God. Jesus has been taken up to heaven then. But the apostles are no longer sad, and in the Acts we may read that when they got back from the Mount of Olives, where it is believed he ascended to heaven, they went to the upper room where they were staying. And our gospel today is set once more in that upper room, at that momentous Last Supper, just before Jesus and his disciples leave for the Garden of Gethsemane. The passage we have heard is the last part of what is known as the High Priestly Prayer of Jesus, a title said to have originated with St. Cyril of Alexandria, 5th century doctor of the Church. It's the prayer with which Jesus ended the Last Supper. A note by one scholar reads,
one of the most beautiful passages in the Gospel, it's the longest outpouring of the Son to the Father, and at the same time the loftiest revelation of himself given by Jesus.
After praying for himself, Jesus prays for his disciples, and then for those who will believe in him through the word of those disciples. May they all be one. And the same scholar comments,
the last petition of Jesus' prayer is that all those who believe in him, the Christians, may forever remain deeply united in the love of God. For this reason, this last section is generally called the prayer for unity.
And as he prays, writes another scholar, Jesus looks across the centuries, addressing also those who will believe in him on the basis of the announcement of the first witnesses. As he looked, did he also see the divisions among Christians the centuries would bring? Divisions between East and West, and at the Reformation between the peoples of Europe. But men of goodwill have always struggled to heal the divisions, and in our own time the ecumenical movement has produced a climate change, though the goal is still distant. The road to unity will indeed be long and difficult, declared the leader of the Anglican delegation to Pope Paul VI at the end of the Second Vatican Council. But he also said, "We believe that the days of mutual fear, of rigid exclusiveness, and of arrogant self-sufficiency on either side are passing away." That statement was made at an evening prayer service for promoting Christian unity, conducted by Pope Paul in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls on December the 4th, 1965. And in the Council's decree on ecumenism, we may read,
"Little by little, as the obstacles to perfect ecclesial communion are overcome, all Christians will be gathered, in a common celebration of the Eucharist, into that unity of the one and only Church which Christ bestowed on his Church from the beginning."
A heartfelt longing for this moment is expressed in this prayer, taken from a book of prayers written by a Catholic priest and a lecturer at an Anglican theological college.
"Lord, I feel very deeply my separation from other Christians when I attend their Eucharist and cannot receive communion. Why must we be so cut off from each other at the moment when we should be sharing you? This should be the time when we are closest together, but it's now that I know most deeply the agony of separation. Lord, if it breaks my heart in this way, how much more must it break yours? We love each other and we love you. Why must we be separated at this feast of love and union? Lord, make it possible for us to worship together in complete union and fellowship, and show us what we must do to bring this about."
And back in the 9th century, St. Dionysius, patriarch of the Syrian Jacobite Church, wrote this prayer for unity among Christians.
O God the Father, origin of divinity, good that is beyond all that is good, fair beyond all that is fair, in whom is calmness, peace, and concord. Do thou make up the dissensions which divide us from each other, and bring us back to a unity of love, which may bear some likeness to thy divine nature. And as thou art above all things, make us one, by the unanimity of a good mind, that through the embrace of charity and the bonds of affection, we may be spiritually one, as well in ourselves as in each other, through that peace of thine which maketh all things peaceful, and through the grace, the mercy, the tenderness of thy Son, Jesus Christ."
A living witness of this active search for unity is the ecumenical community of Thésée in France, founded in 1944 by Brother Roger Schütz, to be an existential sign of the unity of the Church.
"Never resign yourself to the scandal of the separation of Christians, all so readily professing love for their neighbour, yet remaining divided. Make the unity of Christ's body your passionate concern."
So writes Brother Roger Schütz. And this is exactly what the Brothers of Thésée do. Coming from different Christian denominations, Catholic, Protestant and others, they live, work and pray together. And in an address to the brothers while on a visit to Thésée, Pope John Paul II has said,
"Because of your passion for the reconciliation of all Christians in a full communion, because of your love for the Church, you will be instrumental in making sure that the effort desired by Christ to recover the visible unity of his body in the full communion of one same faith never slackens."
One word which stands out for me in our Gospel today is not perhaps immediately obvious as a spur to unity, and yet our Lord said,
"I have given them the glory you gave me, that they may be one as we are one."
And into my mind came those words of Isaiah, transmuted in the music of Handel's Messiah. But in a strange process of what I can only call wishful thinking, what I heard when I put on Messiah were these words, "And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all men shall sit together." The words, of course, are, "And all men shall see it together," or in the other versions, "all mankind" or "all flesh shall see it." Still, with unity in mind, it was, I think, a happy mistake. And glory? "Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but to thy name give glory," ran the old version of the psalm, which today reads, "Not by us, Yahweh, not by us, by you alone is glory deserved." But what is the glory of God? For the Israelites, it was contained in the Ark of the Covenant, for there God was present. And when the Ark was captured by the Philistines, a child was born whom his mother named Ichabod, because she said, "The glory is departed from Israel." For Ichabod is Hebrew for "where is the glory?" In an old dictionary, I found two definitions. The first reads,
"The glory of God, the majesty and splendor attendant upon a manifestation of God."
And Epiphany comes immediately to mind, and that invitation by Isaiah.
"Arise, shine out, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord is rising on you, though night still covers the earth, and darkness the peoples. Above you the Lord now rises, and above you his glory appears. The nations come to your light, and kings to your dawning brightness."
Brightness and glory seem synonymous when referred to God, as St. John writes in his Apocalypse.
"Jerusalem, the holy city, had all the radiant glory of God. The city did not need the sun or the moon for light, since it was lit by the radiant glory of God, and the Lamb was lighted torch for it."
And the same image appears in the letter to the Hebrews.
"God in our own time has spoken to us through his Son, the radiant light of God's glory."
All through the scriptures we find references to God's glory as something bright and shining. The shepherds on the hills above Bethlehem were dazzled by it.
"And the glory of the Lord shone about them, and they were sore afraid."
And then the multitude of the heavenly host fills the night with their exultation, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest," words which we echo in our Sunday Mass. But the glory is not ours to keep, not yet, and its light is sometimes as distant as those stars millions of years away. When the poet Henry Vaughan wrote his Ascension hymn, he was sitting alone at midnight thinking of departed friends, and mourning not so much for them as for himself. "They are all gone into the world of light," he begins enviously, and later exclaims,
"I see them walking in an air of glory, whose light doth trample on my days which are at best but dull and hoary, mere glimmering and decays."
Between the glory of God and the glory of man is an unsurmountable abyss. In his first letter, Peter quotes Isaiah when he writes,
"All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass."
But in our childhood and youth, it seems, we're given a glimpse of the glory of God before it fades into mere glimmering and decays. William Wordsworth expressed the concept powerfully in his great ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood.
"There was a time when meadow, grove and stream, the earth and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now as it hath been of yore. Turn wheresoever I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen, I now can see no more."
Comments one critic, as the poem opens, the vision of the earth we know is bathed in a divine radiance of light. But the mature man realizes that something precious has gone from his life.
"But yet I know, where'er I go, that there hath passed away a glory from the earth. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory in the dream?"
Wordsworth believed in the immortal soul, and while wondering why it was that, with the passing of the years, the glory which had transfigured all things for him in boyhood had fled, and he no longer saw the earth apparelled in celestial light, yet he believed, as the critic writes, that man must learn through his suffering heart and his thinking mind another way into the abiding world of the spirit.
"What though the radiance that was once so bright be now forever taken from my sight, though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. In the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death, in years that bring the philosophic mind.
Age does not always bring wisdom, nor to everyone is given the philosophic mind. And what of those who do not share Wordsworth's belief in immortality? One of these was Edward Thomas, whose vision of glory was marred by these great unanswered questions.
The glory of the beauty of the morning, the cuckoo crying over the untouched dew, the blackbird that has found it, and the dove that tempts me on to something sweeter than love. White clouds ranged even and fair as new-mown hay, the heat, the stir, the sublime vacancy of sky and meadow and forest and my own heart. The glory invites me, yet it leaves me scorning all I can ever do, all I can be, beside the lovely motion, shape and hue, the happiness I fancy fit to dwell in beauty's presence. Shall I now this day begin to seek as far as heaven, as hell, wisdom or strength to match this beauty? Start and tread the pale dust pitted with small dark drops, in hope to find whatever it is I seek, hearkening to short-lived, happy-seeming things that we know naught of in the hazel copse? Or must I be content with discontent, as larks and swallows are perhaps with wings? And shall I ask at the day's end once more what beauty is, and what I can have meant by happiness? And shall I let all go, glad, weary, or both? Or shall I perhaps know that I was happy oft and oft before, a while forgetting how I am fast pent, how dreary swift with naught to travel to is time? I cannot bite the day to the core.
Agnostic he may have been, but Thomas was expressing that well-known feeling of divine discontent, common to every human being, and of which every sensitive soul is aware. And what of that second definition of the glory of God? It ran:
the honour of God considered as the final cause of creation, and as the highest moral aim of intelligent creatures.
Now that's some definition. And St. Paul shows us how to achieve it.
Whether you eat or drink, or whatever else you do, do all to the glory of God.
A big thank you there to Jill Bevilacqua for this reflection on the Sunday Gospel. She'll be back again at the same time next week with another edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, so be sure to join her then. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, time to join Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, interviewed here by Philippa Hitchin. The interview focuses on the message of the 47th World Day of Communications, one which has as theme social networks, portals of truth and faith, new spaces for evangelization, a message released by Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, back in January 2012 at a press conference in the Vatican, a day chosen so as to coincide with the feast day of St. Francis de Sales, patron saint of journalists and writers. In this message, Pope Benedict, who opened a Twitter account at the end of last year, invited people to appreciate the potential of social media sites and urged believers during this year of faith to consider how the presence on these networks can help spread the gospel message of God's love for all people. But stay tuned and listen to Philippa Hitchin's interview with Monsignor Tai.
Monsignor Paul Tai, the Pope's message for World Communications Day, you describe it as the next chapter in the Pope's, the Church's engagement with the latest new media technologies.
Yeah, I think over the last 4 to 5 years, the Pope has been generating a lot of material that is reflecting on the new media as they emerge. One of the things that anybody who's dealing with new media realizes, they're not static. It's a changing reality. We can't just say, there it is, now we've defined it. It's changing. We're not in charge of it. We can't decide how it's going. And I think the Pope's being attentive to it, and this year he's moving on to something that is relatively recent, is, I suppose, the social networks, which have become maybe a very distinguishing feature of how communications happens in terms of new media in general.
We saw the Pope himself opening his new Twitter account. Do you see this as a direct follow-up from that event?
I think this is maybe offering a kind of a philosophical or a theological justification for why that was not just a once-off event, but it was a very important statement by the Pope. I mean, the fact that the Pope was on Twitter is important in itself, but it's also a very important sign on behalf of the Pope of the significance he attributes to new media. It's doing, therefore, then it becomes something that's in many ways, I think, was something that said well done to people who were already present and helping the church be present in new media, and it's an encouragement to others. But I think what he's moving on here is he's stepping back a little bit from the day-to-day, the activities, the operations of new media, and asking two fundamental questions, I think. One is, how can new media and the social networks in particular contribute to human progress? What is required if they are to contribute to human progress? And then a second question he's asking is, what can we as Christians do in that arena to help and to support the development of the social networks in a positive manner?
What we can't afford to do is ignore them. And yet there are those who say the church shouldn't be in such a superficial, as it's often seen, form of communication.
Yeah, I think there are people, and I think many of us were that, who for different reasons, were perhaps reluctant to take it seriously. But what's emerging now very clearly in any kind of survey of statistics, is certainly in the Western world, certainly among younger people, is that this is a fundamental reality in their lives. And if the church is not present in this dimension of their lives, in many ways it runs the risk of being absent from a very important reality for them. So I think that the key thing is, I should say, is that the Pope is back talking about social media again. Why is he doing that? Because of his perception of their importance. It's not just a fad. It's something that's here to stay. And it's something that's changing how we communicate. And therefore, as I say, the interests, Pope continues to have a very positive understanding of new media. Some years ago, he spoke about the new technologies as a blessing for humanity. He's also recognised that they're not just technical things. They're not just changing, but they're changing the very way in which we relate to each other, how we get information, how we form our identity. And therefore, they're going to be increasingly important in our lives. Therefore, he said, let's be attentive. He sees the great potential, and he speaks about the great potential of the new media to create a forum where people can share ideas, can learn from each other, can have their eyes open to a great new world that is around us. But he's very clear that the technologies themselves won't achieve that potential. What's needed is a human commitment and human effort. And I think this is the core at his message today. He's saying that the social networks are not somehow autonomous, independent realities. They are constructed and made what they are by human beings. Very often we hear people talking about user-generated content. I think the Pope is probably guiding us to what we might call a user-generated culture. If the social media are hostile or nasty places, that's because people there are being nasty and are being hostile to each other. And the Pope is saying that for all of us who are engaging with new media, we need to ask ourselves, how are we helping to ensure that new media realise their innate potential to be good for human beings? So at some level, the Pope is also saying is, if we reflect on how new media can help to promote human understanding and human solidarity, then it begins to emerge to us that certain attitudes are fundamental. So basic one, if these are to be social media, then there's no place for the antisocial. There's no placement for harassment. There's no place for bullying. There's no place for destroying the character of another person, if we are talking about a truly meaningful social environment. If we are really committed to these being environments where people learn to discover more about each other, to understand their differences and appreciate their differences, then there's no place for a lack of respect. Respectfulness in our way of treating the other person and engaging with the other person is fundamental. If we're committed to these being environments where people can find information that's reliable and that's trustworthy, where people can find answers to deeper questions, where people can ultimately, I think, go to search for meaning and a truth and a purpose in life, then the social networks, primarily the people who are involved, must be honest and must be authentic. If we are to find in this environment a reality where people can discuss and argue, then it's not just enough to be the one who shouts loudest or who makes the most outrageous claim or who has the most eye-catching presentation. We have to think about persuasion, which involves logic, which involves reflection, and which engages person gently. Another one I think that is very clear is that we're all conscious that in this environment, often we can be anonymous. When you're anonymous or invisible, there's always been that temptation to behave in ways that you wouldn't when you are going to be held responsible. So I think there's an invitation to us to be responsible in this environment. I think the final one that I think is hugely important, and it's an emerging trend among certainly political commentators and sociologists in the States, are being very attentive to the fact that new media, which has the potential to create this great forum for dialogue, have in reality often become places where people retire into their own echo chambers, where I will go and I will read the people who agree with me. I'll comment and support those who I agree with, but I won't engage the arguments of others. And that would be tragic if we ended up all each in his or her ghetto without engaging others. And the Pope is very strong in that, with this lovely sense of his saying, it's not just about being willing to listen to others, but I have to try and understand and welcome what they're saying, and then in that same spirit, contribute what I have of truth, of goodness, and of beauty. So the Pope is saying, in that new arena, we must think about how we share our faith. Two points that are nice there. One is, he said, he's attentive to the question of language. And language isn't just the words we use, it's how we express ourselves. And this is a medium where very often it's about using imagination, humour, images. And we maybe need to recover something of our pre-literary period, where the church was very strong in the use of icons, images, cribs, pictures, stained glass windows. We've the great example of the higher arts of some of the most profound human creations in terms of art have come from Christian inspiration. So we need to put that into the mix so that we capture not just people's minds, but maybe engage their imaginations and capture their hearts. The other thing is very clear on that language isn't just about what we say, it's about what we do. And often it's what we do that's more eloquent than what we say. And he has this lovely sense that in the digital arena, maybe the supreme form of witness will be that willingness to be close to engage with somebody who is different, to listen to his or her questions, to take seriously his or her doubts, not just so I can spin it around and get my answer back in, but genuinely listen, at times patiently with not a lot to say, but facilitate them in deepening their own thinking. And ultimately for us as Christians, our belief is that where people go seriously in depth, where they search in their hearts, there they will find the echo of God's word.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, interviewed by Philippa Hitchin. Our thanks go to both of them. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back at the same time next weekend, so be sure to join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.